Okay, so we're going to go through these, and like I said, in this class, we just don't have time to get into the counter view or the alternative position or the criticisms of these arguments. So last week we did two arguments for the existence of God. This week we're going to do four. Next week we're going to do one. And each one of these seven have, in their own right, they're interesting, they have some power to them, but taken as a whole, all seven of them, you start to create a very compelling case that the Christian belief in the existence of God is rational. That's the point of this. The Christian belief in the existence of God is rational. What we're not trying to do here is create a foolproof deductive argument for God's existence with one argument. So you may have already found with the other two that these aren't extremely compelling that anybody who hears them is just gonna they believe that God exists. No, it's something a little different. It's the Christian belief in the existence of God is rational because we're trying to counter the charge against us that we have an irrational belief. This is very important. Because if you throw one of these arguments out on email or Facebook or just throw it out in Starbucks or something, and it doesn't stick, and people just automatically don't have this belief in God, that's why. It's not really meant for that. And no Christian philosopher will try to tell you that if you just read this, you'll be a theist. They will tell you that you will wind up with the view, if you're a rational person, that these seven arguments point to the idea that the Christian belief in the existence of God is rational. Okay, so to start with the desire argument. So you've already had two, this is your third. The two were last week, this is your third. The desire argument. So this argument was kind of first introduced with some of the thoughts of Augustine, again, third century theologian, 1700 years ago. Then C.S. Lewis kind of made some other remarks about it. But this guy, Peter Kreeft, he developed it much further and put it into more of a philosophical form. So it's a bit more user-friendly. And Peter Kreeft, by the way, is a Catholic philosopher. Okay, and so is this guy, Alvin Plantinga, who I mentioned a few times. So I want to just let you know that we share at least one thing in common, that God exists with our Catholic brothers, if you're one of the people that likes to diss on our Catholic friends. What's that? Augustine, yes. Well, everyone was Catholic before the Reformation. That was a believer in Jesus. So, I mean, yeah, in that sense, yeah. So, if you and I lived before 1500, we'd be Catholic too. So, well, I don't know. It depends. Well, I mean, if you were someone who comes to faith, you would come to faith, with the Catholic Church, and because that's the only church. There is no Protestant church. Well, there's the Orthodox Church, but they're East. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Catholic is, yeah. Okay. In apologetics, nothing really. So you could be this. You could be doing all this stuff that we're doing, and be a Catholic apologetics, and someone standing here, and you out there, and we being a Catholic church, all the content would be the same. So, yes, sir. And we have some, I think.
All the Crusades and everything, they're all under the aegis of the Pope.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think we have some good dialogues. I believe we did a radio show recently on Catholicism. And believe it or not, I don't know if I mentioned this, but one of our guys who's getting his PhD right now, he converted to Catholicism like a couple months ago. Yeah. And he's been on our team for like 10 years, and he's just about to get his PhD from Claremont, which is like a West Coast Ivy League. Yeah, we talked a little bit about it, but not in detail. So some of the guys on our team are super Reformation guys. Like every October 31st, they do this Reformation Day show, because they want to celebrate the Reformation because they just love to diss on the Catholic Church just like the Reformers did. But anyway, it's just kind of fun to think through like all the different Christian perspectives that are out there. You know, we tend to, in the evangelical world, especially in Orange County, tend to just be thinking that this is the right brand of Christianity. No other brand of it is right. But in reality, there's so many different brands, it's just mind-boggling. I'm not saying those are right, because I think we do a lot of things right as in the evangelical world, but it's just amazing to see how many different expressions of our faith there are. All right, so let's keep going here, or get going. So to look at the background for this argument, the desire argument, or the argument from desire, this is a very appealing argument because it's based on sort of these existential reflections about oneself and the universe. So in that sense, it's kind of like, okay, so everybody can kind of think about these things. It's based on empirical observations, meaning empirical meaning through the five senses. This is how we know things. So we look around and we make observations about the universe. And it's also based on practical personal experiences. So it's kind of a cool argument. And this is the easiest one. We're going to get progressively harder as we get through this. Okay, so be ready for the late night difficulty. Okay, so Augustine said this, "Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee." What a, yeah, I use that on some of my signatures and email. This is just such a beautiful passage. "Thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee." When you hear the word restless, what comes to mind? What sort of agitation? Okay, yeah. Unsettled, nervousness. What else? Seeking, worry. Yeah, yeah. This sense of something being beyond us that is coming, sort of thing. Seeking. Yeah. So when he says restless, he's pointing to something that we all seem to experience in this life while we're on this planet for our finite time we're here. So C.S. Lewis takes this line of thinking and he just kind of expands on it a little bit. He says, "Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists." Meaning that whoever's born, they have a bunch of desires, and there seems to be a desire out there, or there's a satisfaction out there for that desire. And then he says, "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." So he's saying, if I find something in me that doesn't seem to reflect well about anything on this planet, and there's nothing that really connects to it, the most probable explanation for that desire that's not satisfied is that it will be satisfied in another world or in another time and space. There seems to be something that it's pointing to that I'm not finding here. So to take this a little bit further, Peter Kreft, who does great talks on C.S. Lewis, if you want to research him online, he's a really easy guy to listen to, but very wise and very very good guy to hear and speak. So if you find any podcasts by this guy or anything online, definitely listen to it. So this is how he puts it. "Every natural innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire." So everything in us, every innate desire we have that's natural, corresponds to some natural object out there. All our human desires connect perfectly to this counterpart natural element found on Earth. "But there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on Earth, no creature can satisfy." Okay, that's the second line in his thought. His thought are the Roman numerals. My descriptions of his thoughts are right underneath. So, nothing earthly, space-bound, time-bound, nor even human relationships can satisfy a spiritual desire, because these desires are pointing to something that's not physical but also spiritual. So therefore, there must exist something more than time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. There must be something else out there. If all other desires have their satisfying counterpart in existence, there must be a spiritual counterpart for this spiritual desire. Okay? So this is something, this is what people call God, or life with God forever, or heaven. It's something beyond the natural. So an actual God and an actual heaven represent the answer and best explanation, or best explain the spiritual desires that humans experience. Yeah, very, very good question. I'm not sure who said that, but Solomon definitely seems to allude to that when he says God has written eternity on the hearts of men. So there's something there to this that's also coming out. Yeah, good point. So what do you think about this? It's intriguing. It sounds like you can resonate with it maybe personally. Maybe others could too. Yes, sir. Yeah, they may say, yeah, hey, you're right, Mr. Christian. In fact, all these things I need to be doing. I need to be going after anything that satisfies my desires, and I should have the right to do it because it's natural, you know. So we should say, okay, go for it. You know, go ahead, and when you get angry, kill someone. When you get, when you feel like you need to have sex, just have sex with whoever is in front of you. And, you know, do whatever you want. You know, if you feel like beating the child, beat it, you know. So it's, you could start to critique hedonism at that point, because that's what they're offering. And you take hedonism to its conclusion, and they'll find that it's an absurd position. So, but you know, that's kind of going off the topic though, because what they're trying to do is say, hey, you know, well first of all, they're agreeing with us that we have these natural desires, and there seems to be a way to find gratification for them. So when they bring that point up, it's like, okay, great, you agree with the first point of the argument, and then everything after that's a red herring. So we have to always get them back to this line of thinking. We're presenting something. We don't want to chase the red herring in their response. But you're right in bringing these ideas up, because that is a common response. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. See that?
Carl Jung.
Carl Jung, the psychologist.
There are certain things that could not package psychologically, and that was the need of a lot of people. Heart, that to take various narcotics and alcohol to circumvent the feelings that they had about that loss, that lack of
Yeah.
So that became the embracing common for
Sometimes I don't know how to respond, but that's that's good stuff. I like that one. So Carl Jung, I mean, coming up in the apologetics class, that's cool. But, you know, that's a really good thought. I mean, even the psychologists can resonate with something like this. So I bet you $1 million, if you present this to anybody, they would say, you know, there is something that I do long for that I don't seem to have represented here on earth. And all the human relationships I have, the love of my life that I marry, you know, and I'm just completely, there's nothing else, I could just die now, you know. Right, but this is the suppression that Romans talks about, Paul talks about. Yeah. But, you know, it's that there's something that calls to us, you know. And I think what's interesting about John Eldredge, you know, his books about Wild at Heart and the one for girls, Captivated. Yeah. I mean, there's something to that. There's something that seems to call us beyond everything physical and everything we can even capture with human relationships. We're called for something more. And that's what this is about. And there seems to be, based on all of the inductive observations that we have in the here and now, there seems to be something that satisfies every desire we have. For hunger, we have food. Sex, we have sexual relationships. We have everything. Everything is just met here on earth. But one thing's not, and that's the spiritual component to us as humans. So this is, I think, a very compelling argument. So let's keep moving into the next one. Let's go to the, what's on your next page? The mind argument. Okay. So this one is something that you may start to remember as we get into it. Some things we talked about when we defeated naturalism. So the mind argument was put forward by J.P. Moreland, and others. My computer is doing weird things. I apologize. I can't function now. Can I borrow this for a second till it? Okay, I'll bring it right back. So C.S. Lewis, Alvin Plantinga again, J.P. Moreland, John Lennox, and Ken Samples are people who have put forward this argument recently. And thank you. And the background is that it's a very interesting argument, I think, because we all have a mind. The question is, how do we best explain the cause of the human rational mind? So sometimes this is referred to as the argument from rationality or consciousness. How do we explain rationality? How do we explain consciousness? We look around the earth, we see a bunch of animals, but us. We are the only ones that have consciousness. We're the only ones that are rational. Every other animal, every other thing we see is irrational. It doesn't have any rationality. So how do we explain this? I mean, what best explains rationality? So Christians say it's God, and we're made in the image of God. Non-Christians say it's not. So let's talk about that. So one version of the argument could go like this. If Christianity is true, we are made in the image of God, then certain features that describe God, consciousness, rationality, free will, intrinsic value, and a unified self, should also characterize human beings. So when we talk about rationality and what sort of a thing is rationality, we're talking about consciousness, free will, intrinsic value, and unified self. That kind of all comprises the idea of the rational self, which is, you could think of as the soul. So it's just kind of a way, when we talk about rationality, we're talking about all these things, including how we reason. So those features, consciousness, rationality, free will, intrinsic value, a unified self, do characterize human beings. Thus, these features provide a degree of confirmation for Christianity. These features come from God and describe Him. So that's the basic idea. This is just one version. So it's the idea that if Christianity is true and we are made in His image, which is what Christians teach, then when we go look at ourselves and when we go look at the world, what do we find? If we are thinking of the human person as an archaeological dig, so to speak, a project, and you were to go investigate what sort of a thing is a human person and do some archaeology on it and start digging in there, what do you dig up? Do you dig up something that is not rational, is not something that would appear to be made in the image of God? Or do you dig up something that is made in the, appears to be made in the image of God, just like He described it in the Bible? So it provides a degree of confirmation if what we find when we investigate and do the archaeological dig corresponds with what Christians teach. And if it is as Christians say it should be, then that provides a degree of confirmation for the Christian truth claim that humans are made in the image of God. So it's kind of an empirical way to justify the biblical doctrine that we derive from Scripture. So that's one version of it. There's another version I'd like to go through real quick. It's on the next page. It says humans are equipped with a mind. So every human has what we call a mind. There are competing explanations for the origin of the mind. Okay, so let's hear the competing explanations. Well, the physicalist explanations fail when we hear them. The theistic explanations succeed when we hear those, and which is described kind of in the version I just mentioned. And the best explanation for our mind is a fundamental mind who designed and created our finite minds. So this fundamental mind is God. Therefore, based on the evidence of the features of our minds, the features that I just talked about up there in parentheses, God must exist or we wouldn't have minds. Okay? So that's the other version. There's some questions. You will hear. Right.
We are at the top of the line, and there's no supreme being.
Right.
Humans are the only ones that can reason.
Right.
Animals, they have tested animals. They're just driven by instinct. So
right.
What chemical is it?
Right.
That causes us to reason.
Yeah, so you're getting at the point here, is that when you have these competing explanations, and their explanation is that we are just a bunch of chemicals, just one big bag of chemicals, and there's just a bunch of C-fiber firings in our head, then which one of those electrochemical signals is your thought, or represents you well, or rationality? Yeah, how can you get rationality from a bunch of electrochemical signals? Great point. Yes, sir.
With regards to the animals not being able to reason, I don't think they're able to reason like humans, but you can still argue that if they have lost experience, and that very much indicates that there's some rational something going on that creates that conditional response when an animal experiences something else, or even the
So, how do they notify self? Okay, but what you're getting at here is a definition of rationality that most people don't agree with. So the non-Christian will have to say that instinct equals rationality. But that's exactly what irrationality is not. But in our day and age, people are doing the opposite and redefining everything. Redefining marriage, redefining everything. So this is the point, is that how are they going to use what they know not to be right to justify their position? And it happens all the time. So we need to say, okay, then you need, how do you define, what do you call what humans have that separates humans? Because we do reason, and you can't say our reason is like instinct. Because obviously what we're doing tonight is not instinctive. And that is what they try to do. They take the plain and obvious, and they turn it upside down. And it's extremely hard to do that with this sort of activity that's going on right now. So let's get into the detailed discussion of this, which we're kind of alluding to right now. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the underlined, and that's the same thing as the above. Okay. So the first point was humans are equipped with a mind. Okay. That's the first point. The second point is there are competing explanations for the origin of the mind. Okay, so now let's hear the competing explanations. So the first explanation is physicalists, if you remember that word from our naturalism discussion, it's just a brand of naturalism that discusses the human person is just the brain. So physicalists contend that a mind is an emergent property of the brain. They say that we all have these brains, and all of a sudden, for some reason in the evolutionary process, we have this emergent phenomena that supervenes on and rides along on the brain. It's kind of like a little ghost mind circulating above your head, you know, doing weird things above you as you walk around. That's kind of the picture that's being presented when they talk about an emergent property. Okay, literally, that's what they're referring to. Something that pops into existence, so to speak, out of nothing. Sound familiar? Now, physicalists contend that the mind is just the brain. You could put the word is there. That the mind is just the brain, and we would use the word mind out of social convention. Ah, now this is getting interesting. This is where the heart of their argument is. So, because they could say that the mind emerges on the brain, or emerges from the brain and supervenes on the mind, they also say that when we use the word mind, we're really just referring to the brain, but we start using words like rationality, consciousness, free will, intrinsic value when we're talking about the mind. So these words, these descriptions, free will, rationality, those are social conventions. Those are a product of our culture. That is postmodern influences upon neuroscience. That's what's happening here. So a philosopher of mind is going to say that human culture has produced, because of our interrelatedness and how we developed as a culture, these descriptions to describe what's just happening naturally. If we just use the natural description, there is no reason to bring our own social conventions into bear on this. Because everything could be explained by C-fiber firings in the head and electrochemical signals. It all could be explained with science. So we don't need to bring into the picture any social conventions. That's the idea. So if you get rid of the social conventions, you're left with just physical activity. Okay, so that's the version there that they offer. Now, our version, theists contend that our individual finite minds are distinct, non-emerging entities from our brains and are best explained by a fundamental mind who's designed and created our finite minds. So we have substance dualism. I don't know if you remember, we talked about that a little bit, where the mind and brain are separate entities, but they're interrelated to each other. They are co-related, and they have a cause and effect relationship. The brain could cause depression or feelings of joy in the soul and in the mind, and the soul and the mind could cause the body to do certain things too, even cause sickness to arise because of, say, or like an ulcer, let's say, because of stress, you know, this sort of thing. So interrelatedness, and cause and effect do not mean that the soul and mind is the same thing as the brain itself. We have to be very careful here, because the physicalists will push us into thinking that because something is interrelated and has a cause and effect relationship, that it's the same thing, it's identical. But that is not true. They can be distinctly separate substances, the mind and the brain, and still be related to each other and affect one another. So this was what, if you remember, we talked about a long time ago, Leibniz. He had a law of the identity of indiscernibles. So if you can't remember that, go back into the naturalism worldview page from about 3 months ago and remind yourself. Standard classical Christian thinking on the matter is that they're completely distinct and always related while we're alive here on earth. Two simultaneous parts of human persons.
Right.
Yeah.
Mind.
Absolutely. And that's called substance dualism, and this is the classical view of the human person. Now, God is also a person. He's just unembodied. Then you have lots going on. So theologians talk about the personhood of God. Now think of that. And then think about you. And think about how you're related to God. It's really starting to become intriguing to find out what God is, because we can learn more about what sort of thing we are and his being versus our being. So this is where theology gets really fascinating. So this is the really cool thing about philosophy, is that it informs the arguments for the existence of God. And here we have substance dualism, a philosophical notion under the category philosophy of mind, influencing apologetics that we can use here on the street. So we rely on J.P. Moreland, who is advancing this thought at the highest level in academia against the world's greatest philosophers of mind, and he's winning these arguments because he's debating and presenting substance dualism in these forums. And they are presenting the physicalist worldview, and they lose, because the physicalist worldview fails, which is the next point. The physicalist explanations fail. So in order to see why the physicalist explanations fail, I refer you back to the naturalism outline, but the highlights of that outline are: physicalists cannot account for certain features, namely consciousness, rationality, free will, intrinsic value, unified self, that characterize human beings. So I don't know if you remember that, but we went through it. They can't account for the certain features that characterize human beings. So their worldview, the physicalist worldview, is too weak. It's too short. It's truncated. It's not broad enough in its scope, because it doesn't make sense of these things. Also, physicalism cannot successfully reduce the mind to the brain or show that the mind and the brain are identical. Again, just what we talked about. They try to say that the mind equals the brain, and substance dualism says the mind does not equal the brain. So the other thing about physicalism is it's self-refuting. And to see that, again, I refer you back to that outline where we have an extended discussion on all of these main points right here to show why the physicalist explanation fails. Overall, we can see that the physicalist explanations fail as they attempt to derive rationality from irrationality. And if you recall, if you were at the Calvary Chapel Veritas conference last October, John Lennox discussed this on, I believe, Saturday morning when he talked about these things. He talked about his debates with Richard Dawkins, and he used these very points. And he wrote a book called God's Undertaker: Has Science Buried God? And he also brings these points out there, that the physicalist explanations try to make sense of human persons, but they ultimately cannot, because they are attempting to derive rationality from irrationality, and there's an extended discussion there. And then back to the main argument here, point four, there are competing explanations for the origin of mind. The physicalist explanations fail. I guess I should have... I guess I wrote that twice. Four and five are already written above, so that's copied in the wrong spot. Yeah, I just really wanted to make the point again. The atheistic explanations succeed, as we are finding out in these 3 weeks with the arguments for the existence of God, and also as noted above with that whole archaeological conversation. And then the best explanation for our mind is a fundamental mind who designed and created our finite minds. And this fundamental mind is God. Therefore, based on the evidence of the features of our minds, God must exist or we wouldn't have minds. So based on the evidence of ourselves as human persons, there must be a God. That's the heart of this. So before it was based on the desire found in human persons, there must be a God. Based on the rationality of human persons, there must be a God. That's the idea here. Yes, sir? Yeah.
If I understand correctly, they don't believe in free will or intrinsic knowledge, correct?
They believe in it, but they define it differently.
Where I was going with my question was, if they don't believe in that, then in a sense we're like robots. But then I would say, then why don't we all do the same thing?
Yes. It's a great point. Yes, perfect, absolutely, and a great critique, because once you lay that into them, they will have to say, well, we are able to freely choose and freely consider other ideas because we do. But then, but that's begging the question. The point is, how can you, based on your worldview? You can't. You agree with me that we do, but you can't explain why you do with your set of parameters, with your thinking. The only thing that explains free will is the Christian worldview, because the naturalistic explanations must fail because we are all instinctively programmed, pre-programmed like a big mechanistic machine, to go capture the prey at this given moment. To go to sleep at this given moment. It's all because we're a big machine. You know, we're all part of the components in the machine. You know, Mother Earth. And based on that, that perspective cannot make sense of free will. So ultimately, they have to choose. Do you have free will, or do you have the naturalistic explanation of human persons? You can't have both. And that's the heart of this. Is that they are automatically going to affirm free will because that's what non-Christians love. They want to be able to satisfy their urges, right? So that's their passion, is to say, I'm a free creature. I can do what I want. Don't impose your religion on me, you know. So they automatically affirm that, but their naturalistic explanation can't make sense of it. So it's a great point. And Alvin Plantinga, again, to go to him, he developed this... this great argument. It's either naturalism as a philosophical worldview to describe the universe, or evolution, but you can't have both. So you could kind of take this line of thinking further and press into them more. And you say, by the way, do you believe in evolution? They say, yeah, of course. Well, you say, well, how could you believe in evolution based on the naturalistic worldview? And because naturalistic thinking is at odds with evolution, and evolution is at odds with naturalistic thinking. So it actually is kind of self-refuting in terms of their holistic worldview. And I give you this discussion in the naturalism worldview criticisms. I don't think we actually went over it that night. I think we ran out of time. But it's at the end of the criticisms in your naturalism section. So that's kind of a cool one because it doesn't have anything to do with Christianity, but it just shows why naturalism and evolution are two self-refuting ideas.
Can you explain briefly real quick the difference between evolution and
Naturalism is just the worldview that says you can describe every feature of the universe with physical descriptions. Because all we are, what's implied with that is materialism, that all we are and all that there is in the universe is just material entities in motion, matter in motion. And that's what we are, and that's what space is, planets, rocks, oceans, everything. Whereas evolution is just the way humans develop from, you know, a common descent. So that's a very tiny little thing compared to the entire worldview. Yes, that's what the naturalist position would say that. Exactly. Yeah, so I just beg you to go open that stuff up and check that out again, because it's really fascinating. And Plantinga, I think, succeeds in his arguments being wrestled around with in a higher academic thought. So with that, let's take a quick break and enjoy some snacks. I believe Linda made some snacks for us tonight. Thank you, Linda. I think she may win the award for the best snack bringer of all time. So, all right. So we'll be back in 5 minutes. So we have two more tonight. And then next week we're going to have the argument for miracles, which is pretty complex, and we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of that. So tonight's kind of an overview of four to kind of get a gist of them all. And, of course, you can, again, write a dissertation or several books about each one of these. And I did make an announcement last week that a lady apologist by the name of Sarah Ankerman was going to be here to present the argument from desire. And she would have either done that for the entire session, and we would have just had the one argument presented, but she couldn't make it, unfortunately. She's getting her PhD from Liberty University in theology and apologetics, and she lives here in Southern California, so I'm not sure how she does that. She flies over there all the time or what, but because I think it's in Tennessee. So anyway, she couldn't make it, so sorry about that. You're stuck with me. So yes, sir. Oh, is it? Really? That's a smart move for them, yeah. That's great. Oh, they're going to move to the Logos building. Veritas Seminary, who put on the conference last year. So, all right. Oh, and they're starting some stuff in August. Ah, so a little pitch there. Okay, you guys ready? So here we go. We're going to talk about the moral argument. The moral argument for the existence of God. Okay, so this is also called the axiological argument, and we'll find out why in a second. So this one is put forward by C.S. Lewis, Paul Copen, William Lane Craig, and Chad Meister, and there are some references again for you to go read throughout the next 7-8 months at the bottom of your page there, just like on each one of these, and just like all the other outlines I've given you, tons of references of all sorts of books that I recommend you go buy and read on your own time, all of them. So so every footnote you've seen so far by each one of those. So the background of this is that axiological is just a word to describe value or meaning or morality or worth. It comes from the Greek word axios. And it's just the study of the nature of value and value judgments. So that's kind of the sense of the word axiological. It has to do with value. And we're talking about morality, so we're talking about moral values. So Christians talk about objective moral values, and non-Christians talk about subjective moral values. And we've talked about relativism and postmodernism and existentialism as the worldviews that give rise to the ideas of subjectivism. So what we're doing here is we're continuing to talk about objective moral values and how objective moral values point to the existence of God. And that's the heart of this argument. Now, this argument answers the question, Where do morals and moral oughts come from? Okay, where do morals and moral oughts come from? Like, I ought to do something, or he or she ought to do something. Where does that ought to do something come from? So do humans create these moral oughts, or are they found in God? Do humans create objective moral values, or are they found in God? Well, the first thing you could say is, no, of course humans can't create objective moral values, because otherwise they wouldn't be objective, they'd be subjective. So the question here is, what is the foundation? Where do we find the foundation? Who is the foundation for OMVs, objective moral values? Okay, that's the question we're asking. So if the non-Christian agrees with us that there are such things as objective moral values in the universe, then he needs to provide an explanation for objective moral values. If he cannot, then he has to only say, no, there are subjective moral values in the universe. There are no objective moral values. And that's basically nihilism, which we talked about before. And I gave you the critiques for nihilism. So this is the heart of the matter. If he denies objective moral values, then he's stuck with the criticisms of nihilism, because he's stuck with subjectivism. If he agrees to objective moral values, then he needs to explain where they come from, and he needs to give an explanation that's better than ours. Yes, sir. Well, we're going to talk about that, actually. The societal norm is nothing more than the cultural, culturally derived values. And we have talked about that with the postmodernism class. So just connect the dots back to that, and you'll have all those criticisms there. So it takes a while, a bit to unpack that, but that's the idea. With cultural norms, society norms, it's all postmodernist language. So I would refer you back to that outline. Okay, so the way this argument for the existence of God works is this. It has a few different versions. Either version is good, but we'll just go through each one and see which one you like better. If objective moral values exist, God must exist. Objective moral values exist, therefore, God must exist. Hey, look at that. That's pretty good. Not bad, right? Those who frame the debate win the debate, right? So this is what you got to do. So another version is like this. If God did not exist, objective moral values and duties would not exist. Objective moral values and duties do exist, therefore God exists. Okay, so these are simplistic sort of syllogisms. And the idea here is that you're following the rules of logic. If you screw up, did and did not, and move these things around, you're screwing up the whole argument and you're going to refute yourself. Be careful. In what's called syllogistic logic, you have two ways where the argument like this, if-then arguments, will work and will be valid, considered logically valid. So you have something called affirming the antecedent, which is the first one. The antecedent is the first thing in the if-then statement. Okay? So you want to be careful here. So I encourage you to write this down at this point, because we're going to get into this in depth, but this is just some basics, right? So when you have the if, and then you have the comma, and then the then, whatever, you want to always, yeah. You sure? What?
The sun is bigger than the
don't know about you guys. Do you write God with a lowercase g? Okay, let me just tell you, God is not offended if you, or the he, if you, when you're talking about God, if you put lowercase h, God's not going to be offended. I'm just going to tell you right now. So, and just to let you know, if you use capital H and you're talking to non-Christian, that's going to get a little awkward for them because it's a little too inflated. Okay. So the two ways that this syllogism could work is you can either affirm the antecedent or you can deny the consequent. And either way, you'll do it right. If you go backwards, you're going to make yourself bad. Look bad. Okay, so don't deny the antecedent and don't affirm the consequent, because you're going to commit a fallacy in your own reasoning. So the first argument I gave you, the top one, that one is affirming the antecedent, because in premise two, it says objective moral values exist, and the antecedent is objective moral values. So you're saying the antecedent is true. The antecedent corresponds to reality. That's the idea. And the second version I gave you, called another version, if you look after the then, which is not there, it's just the comma. If you look there, and oftentimes, and you're not going to find it, the then in the statements, but after the comma, it says objective moral values and duties would not exist. So what we're saying here is that the second premise is objective moral values and duties do not exist, or do exist, sorry. So in other words, it's the same as saying not objective moral values and duties do not exist. So I'm denying the consequent in the second premise of the second form of the argument. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so therefore God exists. So if you set it up right, then you're going to be solid. Now, this is where it gets fun. This is the abductive version. So if you remember from last week, we talked about abductive reasoning. We talked about a bunch of hypotheses, and you look at, like, say, five hypotheses, H1, H2, H3, H4, H5, and you look at all the data, and you'd see which hypotheses best explains all the data out of all the competing theories. And that's what abductive reasoning is, okay? And that's kind of the heart of this, too. So objective moral values exist. That's the first premise. Naturalistic explanations fail at providing an adequate foundation for them. God explains objective moral values adequately. Therefore, God is the best explanation of objective moral values. So if you remember last week, we had all these hypotheses on the board, and then we said this one best explains the appearance of design in the universe. It's the same thing here. We have all of this data for objective moral values. What explains all of that data appropriately or the best? And what explanations fail are the naturalistic explanations. And so all we're really left with is the theistic explanations. So, and that one explains it really well anyway. So that one is the best explanation by default, because all of them are gone because they fail. And so therefore, God is the best explanation for the foundation for objective moral values. Okay, so to unpack this a little bit, we need to look at the first premise of the abductive version, because the first two versions are pretty easy to follow as long as objective moral values are real. So the first premise is, in the abductive version, objective moral values exist. So I'm saying it is unwise to deny objective moral values. It's not smart of anyone to say that objective moral values are not real. And the reason why we say that is because, you and I say that, is because we're foundationalist realists. Remember those words? We talked about in the worldview class. If you're a foundationalist and a realist, you hold that there is no other criteria that requires justification for your basic beliefs or commonsensical beliefs. You don't need to continue to justify your criteria by which you know that the commonsensical beliefs you have are true. And then we are realists because we believe that we have direct access to reality, and reality is really out there. So metaphysical reality is the case, and our epistemological knowing and access to reality is the case. So we're foundationalists and we're realists. Other people who aren't foundationalists and realists fall into skepticism, which is what I presented the first couple weeks of the course, and we refuted skepticism. And if you didn't notice, postmodernism is a form of skepticism. And I was trying to make that point at the time. And so what we're doing here in creating these arguments for the existence of God kind of depends on all the work we did before. So when I talked to you at the beginning of the class and I said, hey, look, if you just stick with me, all this stuff will start to make sense and you will be seeing it over and over again. Again, we saw skepticism of postmodernism, and we're seeing skepticism here in the argument for God in terms of refuting it. Okay. So it's unwise to deny objective moral values, but that's what the skeptic and the postmodernist tries to do, and the existentialist. These are properly basic, self-evident, commonsensical truths about reality. We bump into them. They are furniture in the universe. We go and knock our head against them, and we say, ah, what happened? They are something that we encounter whether we like it or not. It's a self-evident, commonsensical truth about reality. It's simple seeing. We have direct access to objective moral values. Yes. So, objective moral value is something like killing the innocent is morally wrong. Okay? Or killing a vulnerable fetus in the womb, a human person, is morally wrong. Mm-hmm. But that's the question. Is it a human person? That's the issue. Because they would all agree that if it is a human person, and killing it is morally wrong. So even the abortionist upholds the objective moral value. Killing a vulnerable, innocent person is wrong, even if it's unborn. Stealing a widow's land is morally wrong. Molesting a child is morally wrong. You know, these sorts of things. These are objective moral values. Stealing, whether you're a white-collar stockbroker or a guy living off the street, stealing is wrong. These sorts of things. Okay, so those are what we would call objective moral values. They're propositions about reality that correspond to reality and are true. And the question is, why are they true? What grounds the truth of the objective moral value? And this is where you have the philosophy happening. So we'll get into this in a second, what their explanation is for the ground of truth. We say that, and we bump into these things. They're part of the universe, whether we like it or not. They're mind independent. When we say objective, remember, we're talking about mind independent realities. We're talking about things that are true regardless of whether or not anybody thinks about them, or if the whole world thinks the opposite. Like if the Nazis convinced everybody that killing Jews is morally permissible and right for our future evolutionary state, and everyone started killing Jews, it still doesn't mean that killing Jews is morally right. You see what I'm saying? So it's a moral truth that is independent of human thought. Now, humans encounter the moral truth when we think about it, but it's independent of our thought. It exists out there as furniture in the universe, whether or not we think about it or not. Okay. Mind-independent realities, furniture of the universe that exists, whether or not humans think about it. Now, in various cultures all over the world and throughout history, objective moral values have been present. They've been real and available for past cultures to bump into, even in primitive times. And C.S. Lewis, in the appendix of his book, The Abolition of Man, he chronicles various documents throughout ancient eras. We may have brought this up before, I'm not sure. But he looks at the Egyptian, Babylonian, Chinese, Norse, Hindu, Roman, Greek, Jewish, First Nations, Anglo-Saxon, and even Aborigines. And he looks at all these documents from those ancient times, and he shows the appealing in their law to a truth that they find to be wrong, and there are consequences for breaking or violating that truth. So in these documents, even way back then, all around the world, people were encountering these same truths that I just mentioned. No. Objective moral values don't exist in your mind, but you can think about them through your mind. They exist like, you know, a star in space. Think about a star out there in space. They're just there. They're just way out there, but everyone can see them if they just look. So that's the idea. Yeah, you can't run away from them. You can't fight it. It's there. You can deny it, but again, that's the suppression of the truth that Romans talks about. Okay. So these objective moral values are still held today by people all over the world. So they were held way back then in those primitive times, if you will, call it that, or early times. These objective moral values are still held today. So we still bump into them in our advanced world. They still impose their way on us, actually. We rediscover the same ones that they have encountered way back then. For instance, when we hear about sex slavery, we're automatically outraged. When we hear about the girls in Nigeria being abducted, over 300 and more, we are automatically outraged by this. And I don't know who wouldn't be. Or say that that's having these guys come and steal them because they're getting an education and then sell them away into sex slavery and disappear for the rest of their life. That anybody wouldn't be outraged thinking about that. Now, even atheists like Jean-Paul Sartre, Albert Camus, Bertrand Russell, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and more confirm these objective moral values in their writings. So these are existentialists, hardcore atheists, current new atheists. They affirm these objective moral values. So people that are adamantly opposed to Christianity with a vengeance, they criticize Christianity for all of the moral truths that are presented with our belief system. And they criticize all of that and say that you guys are imposing your will on us and imposing your belief system on us. But then here they are affirming these same objective moral values that every human has to deal with. So they are not denying, denying the existence of objective moral values. They even affirm it themselves. And most, if not all, atheists we meet on the street confirm objective morality and are adamant about this point. So even if you are pressed by a freshman in college about this, if you press him on it, if you push back on him, he will affirm objective moral values 100 times out of 100 because he realizes that they are real. And he just says, okay, you're right, I do agree. The other way we know that objective moral values exist is the disagreement between cultures about some moral notions, like torturing prisoners for no reason, or some other human rights violations, say in Russia and China. So if the American government criticizes China for human rights violations, and then they deny it, what's happening here? Are they denying objective moral values? No. They are denying that their treatment of political prisoners, for instance, or something of that nature, is not a human rights violation. It's something different. It's just, oh, we're just giving him a hard time, or we're just tickling his feet, you know, no big deal. You know, something like this. They're not going to deny that they have violated basic human rights. They are going to deny that what they are doing is a human rights violation. They're not denying the existence of the objective moral value. They're denying that their behavior violates the objective moral value. And same thing with us. When we get criticized for Guantanamo Bay and other things, we deny that we're doing human rights violations until we wake up and agree that, yeah, we did torture them, you know. So that's the thing. And then we admit, yeah, you're right, we shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't have tortured these guys in Guantanamo Bay. So the disagreement here is not that they exist, but the disagreement is that people have violated them or not violated them. So the disagreement itself affirms there's a standard beyond that is being appealed to by one nation criticizing the other, and the other nation saying, yeah, you're right, there is that standard, but we haven't violated it. That disagreement, again, points to the existence of objective moral values. And that the final thing we could say about the existence of objective moral values is that when a civil rights reform movement happens in a culture, like with Martin Luther King and with Nelson Mandela and others, you have a society moving closer to what they would agree to be a higher standard of living, where humans are treated with dignity, whereas before they weren't. And humans treated with dignity is a better thing than humans mistreating each other based on race, gender, whatever. So everyone thinks that there's moral improvement towards something, a moral standard that's higher, that we're reaching, we're getting closer towards. Once we get rid of racism and sexism and all these other things, eventually we'll get to that human behavior is perfect. We would be reaching that standard. So reform, moral reform and civil reform in a society points to the idea that there is objective moral standard and norm that we have not yet attained, but we are getting closer towards. So that's, again, evidence, again, for the objective moral value that we all affirm. Yes? Yes, that's a great point. That's a great point. So what about evil? Well, evil also is an objective moral value. It's just a negative moral. It's the absence of goodness, right? You could say, or the violation of goodness. So the existence of evil actually reveals the existence of God in the same way that these arguments were showing above. Because, again, evil is an objective moral value that we bump into in the universe. So what explains the objective moral value evil? What explains the objective moral value goodness? And this gets to the next point. First, we could say that it's hard to deny these objective moral values. So we made that point clear. It's very hard to deny those objective moral values based on those reasons I gave. So do naturalistic explanations, again, explanations where God is unnecessary and everything can be explained through naturalistic explanations, do they succeed at explaining the foundation for objective moral values? So does a naturalistic explanation succeed at explaining evil? That's another question. Well, naturalistic explanations try to show that objective moral values are either both of the following, social conventions or biologically instinctive. And these points have already been brought up in the class. Well, it turns out that these explanations fail. We don't have time to go into them now, but they do. So you kind of have to take my word for it. Or you can email me and I'll give you more reasons on that. They only explain, though, that when these explanations are given, that human morality is subjective. They do fail for a bunch of other reasons, but they don't explain objective moral values. They explain subjective moral values, human morality based on humans. And this type of morality is not objective. But we already said that objective moral values are there, they're real. So if you try to make an explanation for objective moral values, but you're really explaining subjectivism, then your explanation is just irrelevant. But they fail for other reasons, which we don't have time to get into. Are there any other options to get objective morality in a world without God? Can the non-Christian come up with a foundation besides those things, biologically instinctive and social conventions? Well, Nietzsche demonstrated that the result of naturalism is moral nihilism. Nihilism states that there are no morals of any kind, subjective or objective. Well, how does that work out? Not very well. It actually denies objective moral values and doesn't even attempt to explain objective moral values. So nihilism, the result of naturalism, fails to even attempt to explain objective moral values. So we can't rely on nihilism. And also, nihilism leads to despair, insanity, inequality, injustice, and ultimately genocide. So that's not a very good option anyway. And we talked about nihilism. But what about existentialism? Does that explain objective moral values very well? Not so much. Existentialism comes along and says we create our own morality, and we choose to act and create morality. So does that explain objective moral values? That we choose to create morality? Well, we arrive here at subjectivism again, if you recall the existentialism conversation. And we don't arrive at objective moral values. So again, existentialism doesn't offer a foundation for OMVs. And existentialism has its own problems, like we talked about in that class. It leads to subjective individualistic hedonism or utilitarianism. And also subjective individualistic hedonism, with that you have horrendous evil being permissible and even encouraged if it is ultimately for pleasure or higher good. So if someone is a hedonist, then that desire for pleasure is above all, and eventually that leads to just some terrible thinking. So absurd consequences, because if we all were hedonists, then nothing could function, because we're all just satisfying our own urges at the expense of the other. So that doesn't make much sense. Yes, sir?
Is a presupposition that they know about evil as an abstract element or something that they inherently also recognize that they have?
Yeah.
My premise is if you spot it, you got it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Aware of their own evil.
Yeah.
Or if they only spot in others, then it's reprehensible, therefore outside of themselves. But if they have attained to another level of discernment.
Right. So in the problem of evil conversation, if you remember, we talked about how the charge that God is not all good because he permits evil, or not all powerful because he doesn't stop evil. The atheist is admitting there's an objective moral value, evil. And so then, before we even have to respond to the problem of evil and defend God or our belief system, we need to ask them first and put the burden of proof back on them and say, what do you mean by evil? How can you even use that word like you do? Because according to your belief system, you don't have a foundation for explaining objective evil. All evil is to you, according to your beliefs, is a subjective idea, an illusion that humans just socially construct, according to postmodernist thinking. So what happens is, when they're pressed on it, they say, no, you're right. Evil is objective. Evil is real. It's really there and in our universe that we can access. And that's where this begins to be compelling, this argument. Because what we find is that their naturalistic explanations, their existentialist and nihilistic explanations all fail and ultimately lead to absurdity. And so, and this, you know, comes back to this last point here. So for now, the naturalistic explanations of objective morality give us subjective morality, morals that are just social conventions or biologically instinctive, and that has problems. Nihilism and existentialism, and that's no morals or create your own morals, that has problems. And all of these explanations are bad moral foundations, and mainly, which is our point here, they don't explain the foundation for objective moral values, including evil. So because their explanations fail, they ought to be tossed out. What are we left with? What best explains the foundation or the grounding of objective moral values that everyone, including the atheist, agrees to exist? What explains them? They don't have a good explanation, but they agree that they're there. While God explains objective moral values really well. And the Christian perspective is that God exists and morality and moral duties flow from who and what God is. So this is the idea that objective moral values flow from his very essence. And we encounter these things because we are encountering something that God created, and it ties back to who and what God is. That his very essence is good. And we are encountering something that is ultimately connected to his goodness. Now, his nature is the objective and absolute standard that we measure our goodness and our actions to. It's his nature that we are accountable to. So what God says is based on who God is. And what we encounter is based on who God is. Now, objective morals are properties, then, of God's nature. They do not exist independently from God. And the non-Christian will try to bring up what's called the Euthyphro's dilemma. I think I'm saying that right. And it goes back to classical Greek times. And they try to say, and use this against the Christian, that there are objective moral values that exist and God just discovered them, and that's why God presented them to us in the Bible. They exist before and independently of him. Christians say no, they come from his very nature and essence. So there, that's something maybe to look into a little bit more. So something like justice is not out there existing independently, but it's tied to God's nature. It's tied to God's essence. So it's not something that exists independently on its own. So the conclusion is that moral laws require a moral law giver. Moral laws require a moral law giver. And ultimately, that's who we encounter when we encounter objective moral values. So we have a great explanation for the foundation and grounding of objective moral values. They have terrible ones. And so you toss those out, and we're the only explanation left that's any good. Plus, our explanation's perfect. It explains it perfectly. Now, the final argument, it's not a big deal that we don't have a lot of time for this one. And I'll tell you why. This argument is so ridiculously hard and complex and complicated that it's not worth spending tons of time on here. Now, it's very historical in that it's been around for 1,000 years. So we'll turn to it just for a few minutes, and then we'll close the class. And one of the things I'd like to share with you that Alvin Plantinga, one of the greatest philosophers in the world today, who brought in this revival of Christian philosophy of our time in the last 50 years, he said that he would never use this argument or even explain it to a non-Christian. And he thinks it's interesting, but it's not useful. And he even said in this one thing when he was being interviewed to not talk to the, not explain this argument to the popular person, to the lay person. And I'm going to explain it to you anyway, regardless of his advice, because I think it's interesting, although I want to encourage you, don't use this. Don't ever bring this up, but enjoy it for yourselves in your own private study. If you talk to other Christian apologists about it and have a fun chat about it, great. But don't bring it up to a non-Christian. It's very interesting, though. So let's get into this. So this is called the ontological argument. So ontology is the branch of metaphysics. Again, metaphysics is the branch of philosophy that has to do with being and reality. What is real? What is the nature of the real world? So ontology is the sub-branch of metaphysics that has to do with the study of being in particular, the study of existence itself. And this, I tell you, gets really fascinating. So this is very academic in nature. So ontological thinking is any speculative system which starts philosophizing by positing absolute being, okay, like a thing like God, or deriving the existence of entities independently of experience merely based on their being thought. Okay, so that's the idea of sitting back in your Monday morning chair, being an armchair philosopher, and just rationalizing things that you're doing this philosophizing by yourself, and you're not really thinking about the rest of the real world out there. Okay? So this is purely rational. What's that?
What is the significance of this idea?
You'll find out in a second. Yeah. So ontological arguing has to do with arguers of the ontological argument try to deduce the existence of God from the concept of God with other certain necessary truths. Okay, so this is just thinking rationally, and all of a sudden you can arrive at the existence of God. It doesn't have anything to do with observations. It doesn't have anything to do about your existential notion of desire or this feeling of desire that you have. Nothing like that. So once one understands the concept of God, we can see that he must in fact exist. Just by thinking about the concept of God, you can arrive at the conclusion that God necessarily exists. Now, this was first proposed by Saint Anselm, who was alive about 1,000 years ago, a theologian who was a brilliant guy. He actually tutored Thomas Aquinas, whom, as you know, was the what is he called? The theologian of angels, or something like that, or the angelic doctor. You know, he was literally, him and Augustine are the greatest theologians ever. They're just incredible. So he is a very smart guy because he tutored Thomas Aquinas. Now he wrote this out, and I'll just go straight here. So see where it says in number two here. So here is Anselm. This is what he said. And certainly, that than which a greater cannot be conceived cannot be in the understanding alone. For if it is even in the understanding alone, it can be conceived to exist in reality also, which is greater. Thus, without doubt, something than which a greater cannot be conceived exists, both in the understanding and in reality. So what do you think? Did you get that? Is that pretty awesome? Okay, so let's try to formulate what he's saying here to see if you can capture it. So one can understand a greatest conceivable being, it's called this, that than which a greater cannot be conceived. So when you think about a being, God is the being that than which none greater can be conceived. He's the greatest possible being that you can think up or think and imagine. You can't think of anything better than God. He's the ultimately perfect being that anybody can conceive. Okay, the greatest greatest conceivable being is a being we call God. God is that than which no greater being can be thought. Okay, so the attributes of the greatest conceivable being are perfection, omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence, omnibenevolence, and existence. So necessary existence, via the cosmological argument from contingency that we talked about last week, is greater than contingent existence. So if something exists necessarily, something has a greater existence than a contingent being, because it must exist necessarily. So the attribute of the greatest conceivable being is one that necessarily exists. God is the greatest being. That means God is the most perfect being in every possible way, so God is the most real being whose existence is necessary, not contingent. Okay? There are levels of existence, and God is at the top because he is the existence or being in the purest form. So God is the perfect being in all possible ways, and we are less than perfect. So that which must be a necessary existence or being is superior to that which may or may not be, which is a contingent existence or being like us. So somebody who's necessary is greater in every possible sense than something that's contingent. God is one who exists necessarily in any possible world, like we talked about last week. We talked about that a little bit. So the attribute of the greatest conceivable being is one that necessarily exists in any possible world. And this attribute of necessary existence belongs only to an absolute and infinite being, not a finite and contingent being. It is unique and solitary. So something that exists necessarily in all possible worlds. Something that exists contingently may not be the case in any possible world. So necessary existence implies actual existence. If a thing must be, of course it is. And that is the crux of the argument. That's the heart right there. Necessary existence implies actual existence. So because God exists, because God can be thought rationally, just sitting back in your chair, philosophizing, and God can be understood as the greatest possible being, and no greater being could be conceived of beyond him, he's the greatest. Because of that, he's necessary, because if he's the greatest, then he's not contingent. And because he's necessary, he must exist necessarily so in all possible worlds. And anything that exists necessarily implies actual existence. If a thing must be, of course it is. The greatest possible being is one that must exist in actuality. Otherwise, it would not be the greatest conceivable being. So a being that doesn't exist would be less than a being that does. So non-existence, of course, is less than actual existence. And therefore, God actually exists. Kind of like that. Now, yeah, go ahead. Let me hear what she's saying. Go ahead, Carrie. Yeah.
It may be greater, but does it the claim that this greatest being has to necessarily exist is kind of a claim put on it, and so then later it's claimed as the reason why he must exist.
Well, actual existence is not the reason why it must exist. Actual existence is just implied by necessary existence.
Yes, but I'm saying
it's necessary existence is part of being the greatest conceivable being. So that's, again, independent of actual existence. When you conceive of the greatest possible being out there, you can't conceive of a contingent being, because that's not as great as a necessary being. So if you conceive only of contingent beings, well, you can conceive of something greater than that. Then that's the greatest conceivable being. But there's nothing greater than God. God has got all of the attributes of the greatest conceivable being. Nothing is greater than him in any possible way, shape, and form. You can't imagine anything better than God. And that, then his existence is a necessary existence because of the cosmological argument from contingency from last week and based on the principle of sufficient reason. So because of all that, then you can get to the idea that anything that exists necessarily implies actual existence. So if a thing must be, then it is. And that's how you get to the actual existence of the concept of God. So this is... No, God actually exists, but you start with the concept in your mind. I know. But... Exactly. That's right. That's right. And that's right. So there are the criticisms of this argument are significant, but they have been responded to by some of our top-notch philosophers. It goes back and forth. But it's so controversial that I don't agree with you using it. But because one of the people at that time that was writing back to him was saying that, well, I can conceive of the most perfect island out there in the middle of the ocean. So, you know, then doesn't mean that the island is necessary or the island actually exists. So there are other criticisms, like Immanuel Kant brought up some things against this. There, and then there are responses. But again, it's interesting. It's intriguing. It helps us really start to think about God maybe a little bit better. But does it actually work? Does the premises imply or can the conclusion be drawn from the premises? That's under debate. And I think as you study it, you'll get to know it a little bit more and appreciate it more, but also realizes that it's tricky.
The ontological truth became inculcated in me.
Yeah. 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 It's powerful when you start considering God's being and us really encountering his ontology, so to speak. So there was one other question, then we'll close. So there's all these evidences for Jesus, the resurrection, and everything.
And you can't just pick and choose. There's a historical Pilate, there's a historical Herod.
Right.
All these people are actual people in history.
Yeah, well,
and then they can't throw it all out because there's too many truths that they have to admit to that's in there.
Yeah, yeah. I hear you. It's a great point. I mean, the evidential case that is being presented has to be appreciated, even if they reject all of these arguments for the existence of God that we're bringing up. Because what do you do with all of that? You know. But again, what we're trying to do is Christian case-making. We're bringing arguments for the existence of God, historical evidences. We're bringing all this to the table so that they can have no reason to reject an encounter with Jesus Christ. And that's the idea. We're trying to bring down the walls of irrational, the charge of the Christian belief system being irrational. We're showing that it is rational based on these arguments. So I've given you six arguments total. We'll have one more next week. We'll spend the whole class session on it, about miracles. So I am excited about this one. It's a great one to end on, too. So let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you so much for this time and this chance to get to think about you and who you are, what you are, your being, your greatness, and how that reflects on how we can reveal you to others and to ourselves. We also appreciate how you are the foundation for all moral notions, and it helps us make sense of our morality that we encounter in this world, and also how to make sense of us as human persons, and our desire for you and our longing for you. And we pray that you would help reveal all of these truths that we've discovered and reflected on tonight to us more, and help us to express them to others so that they can encounter you in the same way. And we pray these things in your name, Jesus. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.